Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. It's time to join the conversation at americascannabisconversation.com. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
Hello and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation Quick News Update. I'm your host, Dan Perkins. Madison, Wisconsin. Wisconsin governor's marijuana legalization proposal stripped from budget by GOP-led committee. A GOP-led Wisconsin Joint Committee on Thursday voted to scrap the governor's budget proposal to legalize marijuana in the state, one of nearly 400 provisions that were eliminated. In a 12-4 vote, the Joint Finance Committee removed language that would establish an adult-use cannabis market and medical marijuana system. The move was widely anticipated in the Republican-controlled legislature, and it led to calls from Governor Tony Evers and other Democratic policymakers to have residents put pressure on their representative to support the administration's agenda. Evers released details of his proposed legislation through the budget request in February. It would have allowed adults 21 and older or qualifying patients to purchase, possess, and cultivate marijuana for personal use. Residents could possess up to 2 ounces of marijuana, while out-of-state visitors could have up to 1/4 of an ounce. Adults could grow up to 6 plants for personal use. Other budget items that in the committee eliminated include one to expand Medicare, making it easier to have criminal records expunged and to reduce the state's prison population. Washington, D.C., don't punish universities that study marijuana. Bipartisan lawmakers urge in a letter to congressional leaders. Universities that engage in cannabis research should not have to fear losing their federal funds just for doing science, a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers recently said in a letter to congressional leaders. The letter, led by Joe Nugis and Kelly Armstrong, requests that the language be included in the base bill of the forthcoming appropriation legislation, stipulating that funds from the Departments of Education cannot be withheld solely because a given institution is conducting or preparing to conduct research into marijuana. The issue at hand is whether the federal government prohibition of cannabis as a Schedule I controlled substance under the Controlled Substance Act should be basis for federal agencies to withhold funds from higher education institutions that seek to provide a base for cannabis-specific research. The letter, which was signed by 15 other lawmakers, this risk is particularly worrying for institutions in those states and in the District of Columbia that have taken steps to legalize both medical and recreational use of cannabis, and the majority of U.S. states that presently authorize and regulate the issue of medical cannabis by statute. Denver, Colorado. Colorado governor signs bill to expand medical marijuana access to students in schools. Colorado Governor Jared Polis on Wednesday signed legislation to expand access to medical marijuana for students in schools. The governor's office said he also plans to sign another bill that recently arrived on his desk to double the recreational cannabis possession limits in the state. Current law gives principals discretion to set policies allowing or preventing schools to store and administer cannabis-based medicines. But under the new legislation, Polis signed, the discretion is removed and the school boards will be required to create policies on storage of cannabis medicines and allowing personnel to volunteer to possess and administer it to qualified students who need it. The bill is a long time coming, the governor said at the signing ceremony. The governor says he intends to sign the legislation when it reaches his desk. Paris, France. French lawmaker displays marijuana joint in parliament as a new report calls for legalization. A French lawmaker caused a stir on Tuesday when he brandished a marijuana joint on the floor of the National Assembly, denouncing the criminalization of cannabis and calling for a policy change. Deputy François-Michel Lambert said prohibition is a total failure and that legalization would make it possible to dry up trafficking, create tax revenue, and create jobs before showcasing a cup with cannabis leaf on it and then pulling out a joint from it. Other countries have chosen to face the problem rather than an ostrich policy of France, the deputy said. And that's your America's Cannabis Conversation quick news update. I'm Dan Perkin.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us today is Sheila Vicaria from the Drug Policy Institute. We have a fascinating subject today on consumption of cannabis by young people. Sheila, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Please tell us about the study. It's very important.
Sure. So we are really heartened by the recent results of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. For those of you who don't know, every year the Center of Disease Control conducts a national annual survey in all 50 states and D.C. with high school students between the ages of 9th and 12th grade. And every year they collect data on a variety of mental health indicators, substance use indicators, and a variety of other issues. And they release the data as quickly as they can after they conduct the study and do the analyses. And just a few weeks ago, we got the results of the preliminary analyses of the 2019 survey data, in which they teased apart drug use and alcohol use trends among young people that completed the survey in 2019. And what we found was that the most recent report that they released actually did some analysis on the past 10 years of this survey, so between 2009 and 2019. And they really tried to give us a broad snapshot to get a sense of drug use patterns among our young people over the past decade. And what they found was really interesting. When it came to marijuana use, an interesting trend that occurred that they found was that among young people in high school that had been surveyed over the past decade, they found that actually since 2013, between 2013 and 2019, we're starting to see slight decreases in the number of young people who said that they had ever tried marijuana. And this is really interesting, an interesting finding, because for those of you who keep an eye on the headlines and kind of are watching policy change happen, you know, since 2013, and actually since before 2013, we've seen a number of states move forward in increasing access to medical marijuana, and we've seen the significant portion of states that have legalized access to happen in the past in the past several years. The trend that shows that marijuana use, like lifetime ever marijuana use among young people, has actually gone down kind of goes against some of the fears that have been stoked all this time that if we legalize marijuana, more young people are going to use it. And so, first of all, the fact that they said that that the number had actually started going down and the number of kids who had said, I've ever smoked marijuana in my life, but that also when they looked at just, you know, have you used marijuana in the past 30 days, that number didn't increase either. And taken together, this, again, really challenges and pushes back against this idea that if you move towards progressive marijuana reform, increasing access to medical or increasing access to adult use, that somehow, you know, what's going to happen to the kids? They're going to see it as permissive. They're going to see it as safe. They're going to start using it more. And instead, what this national data tells us and suggests is that despite the fact that these policies are moving forward, young people aren't necessarily using at higher rates. And some of these fears perhaps were, while well-intended, actually not grounded in the evidence. And this confirms, you know, broader studies that have come out of some of the states that have legalized, showing that, again, you know, youth use rates have not increased in their states and in some cases have gone down. So that's kind of a quick snapshot of the research.
So this study was the review from 13 to 19 and also what happened in 19. And correct me if I'm wrong, did you not say that it was all 50 states?
All 50 states and D.C.
Mm-hmm. And D.C. And so what had happened in that 10-year period is on a local basis, state basis, we had a number of states who decriminalized marijuana consumption.
Legalization. Yeah.
Right, but when you had all 50 states, they had opportunity to capture those people who at the beginning of the time of the period didn't have any legal use of it at all to where the other ones that came on board. My question is one of the quote, in my opinion, fallacies about and misnomers about cannabis is that it's a gateway drug to harder drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any evidence in this work as to whether or not people started with cannabis and went to opioids or heroin or cocaine?
So one of the things that this study did do was that they tracked, as I just said, you know, marijuana use trends over this decade period. And what was interesting is where I said, you know, lifetime ever use of marijuana in the past several years went down, but, you know, recent use among the folks who did continue, like, didn't increase. But what's interesting is that cocaine rates went down between 2009 and 2019. Methamphetamine also went down in that decade. You know, heroin use, injection drug use, and synthetic cannabis use, synthetic products like K2 or Spice. And so if you look at this more nationally, you know, despite the fact that in some ways marijuana use has not increased, the use of other drugs has actually gone down at the same time, right? And you would think that, you know, people want to say that, you know, marijuana is a gateway drug to a variety of other drugs. And if you see increases in marijuana use, you're going to see increases in other drugs. This research just kind of showed just general trend lines down. And, you know, we have to question also this broader framing of the gateway drug idea, right? You know, most young people who experiment with multiple different classes of drugs starting at a very young age, typically, you know, when we think about the gateway, we also have to think about gateways of trauma, right? Gateways of depression, anxiety, untreated other mental illnesses, or, you know, challenges at home or lack of, you know, access to other opportunities, right? You know, this fallacy that we can pin any drug as being the cause of you using another drug doesn't really acknowledge that people are the ones who choose to put drugs in their body, and that oftentimes when people, especially at very young ages, want to use any variety of drugs, oftentimes something preceded that, and some other challenges often kind of led them to perhaps seek out self-medication or have increased access to those substances. So I also just generally, you know, this evidence doesn't suggest that the gateway theory of marijuana exists, but I also just want to challenge the idea of the gateway theory of a drug rather than understanding that there are social, emotional, and psychological gateways that lead kids to have to find ways to cope with, you know, challenging life situations.
I think you're making a tremendous point. I want to put a finer point on it and say that COVID-19 and the isolation that we as a nation have gone through, we have seen an uptick in suicide. We've seen incidents, in talking with doctors, incidents of depression and anxiety,
mm-hmm.
and an increase in the number of prescriptions in the medical states for young people to deal with depression. And so your point that you're making is that there are things that are impacting the need and the desire and the want to deal with anxiety that's in our lives. And this has been a terrible experience. I find it fascinating that many of the states that had adult use and medical use of cannabis designated those facilities as critical and allowed them to stay open and to provide assistance. One of the areas that was there any differential between males and females in the most recent report?
I have not looked that closely to see if there were gender differences. What I can do is I can share a link to the study so that you can share that with your readers on your website, so people can dig a little bit deeper if they'd like to understand that, and look at that kind of stuff a little bit more in depth. But generally speaking, we typically see, you know, just if I were to kind of make a broader statement, typically that younger boys tend to use most drugs, most substances at a higher rate than girls, although in some cases the gender difference isn't so stark. But I can't say that right off the top of my head right now for this survey's results, unfortunately.
Okay. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the future. What are you working on? What studies are you tracking now that you might be bringing information out in the future?
Sure. So
anything,
I mean,
you can speak about?
Yeah, I mean, DPA is always interested in tracking prevalence rates, particularly among youth, because we do care about youth access to medical or adult supplies of marijuana, and we believe that the more, you know, stronger policies that we have in place for regulation, the less likely when we pass those laws in states that young people will get access, right? And, you know, we know that, good regulation and, you know, stores that check ID, that have trained staff, we can make sure that, you know, youth stay safe. So we will continue to keep an eye on the youth prevalence rates of drug use. We also keep an eye on broader national trends for drug use. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which is a national snapshot of anyone over the age of 12, so it includes adults as well, those results typically come out in December that give us a snapshot of broader drug use trends and drug treatment trends among Americans of all ages. And so we'll be keeping an eye out for that study. But in general, I continue to keep an eye out on studies that really, you know, link public health outcomes to marijuana reforms, because we do believe that the more we can do to provide regulated and safe access to substances with good public education, the more likely we can keep our public safe and healthy.
Well, we've got about a minute left. I want to ask you one question. What do you think is going to happen with the MORE Act vote?
So, you know, it's still up in the air, but we're hopeful, right? I mean, we've had some really tremendous support on the ground. I mean, time and time again, national surveys continue to show that the American public, regardless of party affiliation, generally understands that marijuana legalization should be part of our broader policy conversation. And increasing numbers of Americans, also across aisles, suggest that people do believe there are potential medical and therapeutic uses for marijuana. And so I think it's really important for those of us living and working in states across the country to let our Congress folks know, your House of, you know, your representative, but also your state senators, to let them know that passing the MORE Act and descheduling marijuana is an important priority for you, because the more that senators specifically hear from their constituents, particularly in states, in red states, the more likely we might be able to actually be able to pass this, because we have a sense that there is growing support among the public, but that public has to really let their representatives know that they want them to take that vote to the floor and they want them to support it. So I would definitely encourage listeners on the phone to do a little bit of research, find out who your representative is, find out who your state senator is, and to shoot them an email, write them a tweet, you know, make a call and let them know that you want them to pass the MORE Act, that, you know, marijuana has been scheduled for far too long. It's limited far too many research opportunities. It's led to far too many people being left behind bars. It's created fear in people who live in states with legal medical or adult use access, for fear that the federal government will come for them, and we need to alleviate that fear and open the door so that more states can work towards legalization, but that also the industry can, you know, get the banking support that they need, small business owners can take out loans, and we can really move forward as a country.
Sheila Vicaria from the Drug Policy Organization, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Conversation, and joining me today is a special person who I've talked to about an absolutely fascinating subject and very timely. We're talking about Dr. Therese Costin, who is a professor at the University of Houston in psychology. Welcome to the conversation, Doctor.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for finding the time in your schedule. Ladies and gentlemen, the reason why the doctor's on this show is that she's doing some amazing research, and I know what I'm about to tell you doesn't sound like it's possible, but it is. She's going to explain it to us. She's doing research work on creating a vaccine for people who are on opioid addiction. That's a mouthful, and that's exciting. Doctor, tell us about what you're doing.
Okay, we're creating a vaccine against fentanyl. And what we do is try to use the power of the body's immune system to develop antibodies against the fentanyl so so that in the future, if someone uses fentanyl, it will capture the drug and sequester it in the blood so that it doesn't reach the brain where it has all of its behavioral and physiological effects.
So you just, from my standpoint, you just blew my brain apart, because as we talked before, when we talked about the COVID-19 vaccine, in the classic sense of a vaccine, none of the COVID virus is used to create the vaccine. In the case of what you're doing, you're using a more protect, and I'm not the doctor you are, but you're using a portion of the fentanyl drug to help create the vaccine, which is more in common with why we have developed vaccines in the past. Is that correct summary?
Yeah, it's a little more like the classic type that most people are familiar with, like, you know, against polio or diphtheria or tetanus or something like that. We take the fentanyl drug, which your body will not make antibodies against. It's a small molecule. It easily crosses into the brain from the bloodstream once it gets into the body. So we have to modify fentanyl by just attaching a protein to it. And that's a protein that your body will recognize as a foreign, you know, agent that it needs to attack. Your immune system will start to create antibodies against this sort of modified fentanyl chemical. So in that sense, it's very similar to like our kind of classic idea of vaccines, where the body creates antibodies against this foreign object. We just have to make the fentanyl look like a foreign object.
So again, I'm not a doctor. I'm just fascinated by this whole vaccine scenario. With your vaccine, one of the questions that a lot of people are asking about the COVID-19 vaccines, with no COVID-19 in it, everybody's asking, well, how long is it going to last? And we had the president, CEO of Pfizer, tell us you're probably going to need a booster shot in 6 to 12 months after your shot sequence. And then you're probably going to need a revaccination every year. This case, we're talking about underlying item being fentanyl, and you're creating a vaccine. What's your expectation of how frequently a person who's been addicted to fentanyl would have to take your treatment?
Well, we anticipate that we would need to give probably, you know, an initial shot, then probably like two more boosters spread out over, you know, a few months. And after that, it might have to be yearly. It's hard to know at this point because we're still in the development phase.
Let's roll the clock back. How did you get interested in this subject?
Well, it was something actually my husband was working on years ago with creating a cocaine vaccine, and I came into it after we were working on developing a methamphetamine vaccine, and I just got involved with the preclinical testing of it. I like the approach. It's a very novel approach to a treatment for addiction. And
yes,
it could be a game changer.
Well, you and I talked about the possibility, even though the fentanyl is a artificially produced narcotic, you just mentioned cocaine, there may be other drugs that are being abused habitually that your protocol could be used to create treatments for those drugs too.
Yes, and it's very specific. You know, you would have to create a vaccine for cocaine, one against methamphetamine, and nicotine. Actually, all of these have been done in the, you know, preclinical phase, and pretty much anything you could think of, except alcohol, because alcohol is just chemically very simple. There's nothing that you can't, there's no way to attach one of these proteins to okay. alcohol.
So where are you in your progress?
Well, we've already created a vaccine, and I just have to say that, you know, this is a group effort. I have a colleague who's a medicinal chemist who takes the fentanyl and changes it so it has extra protein on it. And we are also testing how that, in combination with an adjuvant, and an adjuvant is another chemical that boosts your immune system, so it, you know, revs it up so that your body will actually, you know, create as many antibodies as possible. And so we've been testing this to see if it's functional, if it actually blocks some of the fentanyl effects. Fentanyl is an opiate that's used a lot for anesthesia and for pain relief, you know, mm-hmm. in clinic, in a hospital, under the control of an anesthesiologist. So it's a very effective pain medication, and we can test if it sort of blocks that effect of fentanyl, also test whether, you know, if you get too much fentanyl, it will depress the respiratory system. So we can test that as well to see if it blocks that. So we're not the human test stage yet. We still have a ways to go before we get there.
I was just going to ask you, where are you in the chain? Are you anywhere close to launching a phase one trial, or where are you?
I imagine if everything goes well, which is rarely the case, we should be able to start doing some human trials in maybe about at least 2 years, maybe 3 years.
Wow, that much time. Wow. So
we're an academic institution, not a drug company.
A couple of years ago, my wife had to have hip replacement surgery, and the surgeon wanted to give her an opioid for pain. Mm-hmm. And she said to me that she did not want to be on it more than 7 days. And because she was terrified of the possibility of becoming addicted to the opioid. And when we came home, and I had a refill prescription, and I went to the store, and it was 99 cents for like 100 tablets. I mean, it was incredibly cheap. Is it because it's so cheap is why it's so prevalent as a drug for people that are using all over the country or all over the world?
Yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. You know, it's, you know, supply demand, and there's, you know, a lot of different kinds of opiates that are around, and different ones have been problems in different times. You know, heroin, for example, or OxyContin that gets, you know, diverted and turned into street drugs. And, you know, if there's like a demand, there'll be a supply.
There is a strange dichotomy with fentanyl. It seems to be, for lack of a better description, the drug of choice of the poor. If you look at all the places where we're having fentanyl overdoses, they tend to be in rural and poor areas, blacks and other minorities. But it seems to be economically driven in terms of the poor, the ones who are consuming and dying by the tens of thousands of overdoses. Why do you think?
Well, fentanyl is a very potent opiate, meaning you don't need very much of it compared to some other opiates. So in that way, you know, it kind of gets back to your previous question. It's relatively cheap because, you know, you don't need too much of it. And also drug dealers are lacing other drugs that they sell on the street, like methamphetamine and cocaine, with fentanyl. So people are buying it not knowing they get fentanyl. So that's actually part of the reason for this, you know, huge increase in fentanyl deaths. You know, it was not that it was people were intentionally taking it. I'm not a sociologist, but, things that I've read, perhaps there's this pain of loss or social pain that's not like, so much as a physical pain like we think of that. Opiates are very good at numbing that kind of pain too, and that may be perhaps a reason why it's prevalent among poor people. That's just my speculation.
Well, thank you. Unfortunately, Doctor, we're out of time. We've been speaking to Dr. Therese Kosten, who is a professor at the University of Houston, and she's working on a vaccine to deal with opioids. Doctor, how can people follow you and your work?
You can search for me on the University of Houston website. I have a webpage.
Okay, super. Thank you for joining us.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com. Time now for the lowdown on another high time experience. Here's 420 lifestyle correspondent Rich Walkoff.
Well, if you're living in one of the 36 states which has legal marijuana or one of the 16 states that permits growing and adult use for any reason, my friends, you are enjoying the herb thanks in great measure to one Mr. Wayne Justman, longtime activist for social justice, AIDS, LGBTQ rights, who received the very first legal medical marijuana card in the U.S. just about 20 years ago. Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation, Wayne. Awesome.
Card's right there. Hey, it is such a pleasure to welcome you and friends here into my home here in San Francisco. I'm so delighted of your interest in this plant and us educating what we've been through, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, I've been there for a few. But
yeah. Well, you're numero uno. So what did it mean and how significant was it? And we look in retrospect, maybe there wouldn't be the cannabis acceptance as we know it today without what you and your friends did 20 some odd years ago.
If you can recall, the feds were all over our ass. They were harassing doctors for writing anything. In other words, not a prescription. You didn't have something that you could take to Walgreens or CVS and say, this is prescribed for me. No, a doctor's written oral or written recommendation was all they needed. And when they came in and raided us at 1444 Market Street, the Cannabis Buyers Club, they took all of those records. Therefore, all of the doctors' names, their addresses that we've used are now available. And so now they want to harass the doctors. They couldn't get to the cultivators yet, now talking 25 years ago, because they were not expertise in Humboldt, Trinity, all of those counties that are growing our cannabis. They didn't have that. So what do they want to do? Oh, we'll harass the patients by raiding your dispensaries, and we're going to harass the doctors who write these things out. Our government does very well harassment, and that's what the hell they started to do.
Now, how did you beat the system?
We were fortunate, Rich. We were fortunate in a couple of regards. One, the political system in San Francisco was so ripe at that time. And the reason why I want to say that, the AIDS epidemic was just getting a grip in the 90s. I don't know anybody that did not know somebody that had the virus. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anybody that didn't have the virus. You went to classes with them. You rode them on the bus. You worked with the same office. They went to the same synagogue as you did. You knew somebody. And in those days, what the hell is the Department of Public Health going to do about it? And what the hell are the Board of Supervisors going to do about it? And the fortunate thing, in those days, we had people who were understanding. As we said before, Willie Brown was very, very receptive to medical cannabis. And as I said before, and I'll say it again, the only thing Willie suggested is, Wayne, don't dirty me up. And I said, that's my boy, Willie. That's a good politician. Just sounded like Richard J. Daley in years ago when I was in Chicago with Richard. We can't give enough respect to Terrence Hallinan, our district attorney. He was a chief law enforcement official in the city and county of San Francisco. He could have cut us off immediately. Not in my town, not in my county. He did not. He was very, very supportive of, as a matter of fact, he helped. He was over at the dentist's a number of times and with me a number of times, there's photos, et cetera, et cetera. I'm blessed that that man was there. Then we had a board of supervisors. Chris Daley, Tom Amignano, Angela Aliota were very understanding of cannabis at that time. And then, of course, Mitch Katz was the Department of Public Health. And all the stars rode up. I could go on and on. That everybody was there for us. We didn't have an obstacle to overcome, even law enforcement.
So that made San Francisco the epicenter of the medical marijuana movement, which in 2000 became the reality. Well, actually in 1996, right? Prop 215.
Prop 215 passed in November 1996. We had to do something. That was one of the things that I was asking people. What are you going to do about it? We got people that are sick and dying. The AIDS epidemic, you remember that stuff. And like I said, everybody knew some, but you got to do something about it. Now, we were realizing, as Dennis Perone did, that, you know, those of us that are using cannabis find some type of relief. Now, of course, we understand the boogeyman all about cannabis and don't do that and don't do that. And what does our government want to do? Oh, we got Marinol. Oh, let's get some artificial stuff that, okay, fine. So a good soldier like me that needs it, I take the Marinol. Well, I'm sick the next day from that stuff. My stomach is upset. Now, what are you supposed to do? You know, the AZT and the Zerit that we were taking were the only things in 1987 when I got the virus that you had. We didn't have cocktails or something like that. And at that time, with many other people, is the medicine going to kill us? Or will the virus kill us? And I'll tell you something, friend. That was a concern of ours. And then in rode Dennis and the opening up of cannabis and dispensaries here in San Francisco. And it just was like a domino. One slowly fell after the other after the other.
And that's how you got the moniker, the Godfather of Weed, huh?
I was telling to someone today, there's no... I'm the elder statesman of this movement because Brownie Mary is gone and Dennis is gone and Jack Hare was gone and a lot of the people that were they're gone. But I was one that pushed the table a little bit. Yeah. When you ask about the card program, people thought I was crazy.
This is pre-215, pre-Prop 215.
No, this is just after.
Okay.
Just after.
But you had a dispensary before it was all legal, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We had to. The Island Bar that we had at Dennis's and then 184 Church Street that we moved to, we had to. And that's where these cultivators had an opportunity to bring in their product. But also, too, where could you go? Dolores Park? The Tenderloin? Where are you going to go to get your cannabis? Many of us are sick. What are you doing? Is forcing females out there to get your cannabis, and you've got to take every risk of going into the Haight or some other area that's a little jeopardized, and you have to take that risk? No. It's not necessary. So we've already established that credibility, and then I'm thinking, how the hell do we protect the patient? And I said, the only thing that I think that we can do is get some legality to that patient, et cetera, et cetera. So... and again, everybody was in thing. I said, Willie, I need to go to the public health department. Terrence, I need to go to, go. Mitch Katz was there. And I said, all I want the public health department to do, put your name on a card.
So the stars were aligned and you, one of the founding fathers, I'm going to put you on Mount Rushmore. Okay. Get a good rush.
High on Mushmore.
Yeah, right.
High on it.
And how about Kamala Harris's role? Kamala Harris, our new vice president, and you were on a committee back a couple of decades ago that was looking to advance the cause?
Yeah, I showed you a photo here that I have of what's called her advisory group. And what it was a number of us at that time, 2003, who were involved in the cannabis movement. And she's coming in after Terrence Hallinan was defeated. And of course, Terrence was our right-hand man. You couldn't ask for a better guy as our district attorney to help us. And he did. So in comes Kamala. And I remember meeting Kamala for the first time at a cafe up on in Hayes Valley, sitting across from her, and I, Kamala, we can't support you. So after the first day I get down there to participate in this meeting, there's a greeting area, and I come up, and there are two women, and I said, Wayne Jessman to see Kamala Harris, okay?
Well, the groundswell is growing. The acceptance is growing, and even worldwide. I mean, you look at your impact, not only on San Francisco and all the patients for AIDS and those who are very sick who needed it as medicine, but look at the burgeoning industry, and you look at your role in that. I mean, what does it do to you?
It humbles me. I'm a patient. And here I am many, many years later, and I don't know how quickly the world will catch up or our society catch up on this being a very medicinal plant that has many valuable uses to the human body.
You had a phrase that all marijuana use
all
is
use
medicinal.
Yeah, all use of cannabis is medical. Even the thing with it is that if you and I want to go to Napa and have a glass of wine, et cetera, to relax a little bit, that's fine. Well, let's you and I stay here in San Francisco and smoke a joint and relax a little bit. That's how I interpret this. We're not out destroying property. We're not out subterfuging society. We're enjoying the use of a medicinal plant.
Right. No harm, no foul. And I think there's a burgeoning energy to advance that cause, that you're no longer fighting the uphill battle. I think we've turned the corner.
That battle with the government has been over. We just need to teach not only the deniers, but those that are not educated enough about this. When a governor in one of the Midwestern states, there the legislature had passed cannabis, and oh no, he had to veto the whole thing. And in other words, destroy the will of the people. And for what? I still miss all that. Why? Yeah. Why are we beating up on this cannabis plant? Why?
Well, it threatens some pharmaceutical alcohol industries and the like.
Oh,
and if you touch money, you
mean those profits? And also, too, I was online this morning about all of these corporations, 28, that don't pay taxes. So all you folks listening to this, you run and pay your state and federal tax because others aren't doing it.
Yeah. Hey, Wayne, great catching up with you. You look awesome. I'm glad that you have achieved as much as you've achieved. And what's on the horizon? You just living the chill life now? Or are you still an activist and
no,
an advocate?
I'll be going over to the Castro Castle this afternoon. That's Dennis Perone's home. And we'll visit with them. I do some advising. People will call me and say, listen, Wayne, can I use your name, or can we have some advice on some things that moving forward? The problem right now that I'm seeing is over in Los Angeles, and I'm working with some people down there, 2.5 years for an equity program. That's crazy. That's just really crazy. And up here, over a year to get your permitting as far as if you're trying to get distribution or having a cannabis cultivator situation or even a dispensary. Much too long.
Yeah.
So this legalization stuff, folks were anxious, like, let's legalize it. But they didn't realize at what cost
we
do it.
And now that's still being worked on in a big way.
Yeah, 64, I think, paralyzed us a lot. The fortunate thing, I was just talking with some people this morning before you got here, that are trying to undo 64. Now, it's going to take another proposition because it was a proposition, but they're trying to undo it and challenge some of these aspects in court. It's going to, you know, what a mess.
One of the pioneers of the activist movement for marijuana and the AIDS epidemic and LGBTQ community and the like, you've been awesome. Wayne Jessman on the W420 Radio Network. For more, if you want to hear this again, go to W420RadioNetwork.com and check out the archive. Rich Walkoff on the W420 Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dan Perkins for your Songs and Stories for Soldiers Veterans Tip of the Day. What veterans who are homeless or at risk of homelessness should do for help. Veterans who are homeless or at imminent risk of homelessness are strongly encouraged to contact the National Call-In Center for Homeless Veterans at 877-4-AID-VET. That's 877-424-3838 for assistance. If a veteran does not have access to a phone or the internet, only then are they to visit the closest VA medical center without calling in advance. All veterans should contact their VA medical center before visiting for any reason. These steps are necessary to prevent the spread of COVID-19. So here's your veteran's tip of the day. Contact the VA at 877-424-3838 for more information. The VA wants to help. This has been your Songs and Stories for Soldiers Veterans Tip of the Day.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us today is a gentleman who's been on our show before, and I wanted to have him back to talk about something very specific. It's Dr. Norbert Kaminsky, and he's doing a lot of research with Canada's in treating inflammation in various diseases and parts of the body. Dr. Norbert, thanks for coming back again.
Thank you, Dan, for having me.
I invited Dr. Norbert back because I read more and more every day about inflammation from lots of different illnesses and problems, from COVID-19 to pneumonia to AIDS to lots of different things. And I thought it would be important, since he's studying this inflammation process, let's have him back and talk about inflammation in the human body. Doctor, thank you for coming back and helping us to understand inflammation and why the things that you're working on are so important. So let's help the audience understand how inflammation occurs in the human body.
I want to start out by saying that inflammation in itself is actually beneficial. And so inflammation is one way in which our white blood cells are able to respond to various pathogens or infectious agents, bacteria, viruses, and so forth. And so that is part of how our body protects itself against these invaders, so to speak. The problem occurs when inflammation happens inappropriately, so that it can also be induced or initiated by things like tissue damage. And so when it happens inappropriately, it can, especially if it's very strong, it can lead to damage and destruction of our tissues. And it turns out that inflammation, not only is it beneficial, but it can also be part of many, many different disease processes. So, for example, we know that inflammation of the joints leads to damage and arthritis. That's just one example. And so our work is focused on using cannabinoids to try and temper that inflammatory response when it's inappropriate. And we study it primarily using human white blood cells, which we can study in the laboratory under very controlled conditions, and we can mimic activating white blood cells in various ways, again, in these culture conditions, and then study the effects of these various compounds that are isolated from cannabis. And so that has been one of the approaches we've taken. Historically, we also worked in rodent models, but to be honest, rodents are not small people. And so most of our work over the last 10 years has focused primarily on using, you know, white blood cells from either healthy or diseased individuals to try and understand how cannabinoids can modulate that immune response to temper it.
You answered the next question I was going to ask you, but maybe a little more detail. I was curious how long you've been doing this, and 10 years ago, the environment to do testing on cannabis or with cannabis was much different than it is today. How has that ability to test and do research changed over the last 10 years?
Yeah, well, we've been working in this area since 1991, and my laboratory was the first to identify what are termed receptors or proteins on the surface of white blood cells to which these cannabinoids bind and initiate their biological activity. I can tell you that up until maybe just a few years ago, there was very little interest from the primary funding agency that funds research, biological research in the United States, which is the National Institutes of Health. So historically, most of the funding by NIH focused on cannabis research has been to study the detrimental aspects of not only cannabis, but more broadly, drugs of abuse. And it has really only been within the last 4 or 5 years that there has been a shift in that some of the funding for research that they have has been directed to also look at some of the therapeutic, potential therapeutic benefits that could arise from compounds like those isolated from cannabis.
We have a doctor who has been on our show a couple of times, who's a researcher at Harvard, and he's studying the impact of cannabis on pancreatic cancer. Mm-hmm. But when he started his research, he couldn't buy it anywhere in the United States because in Massachusetts it wasn't even legal for medical. And interestingly enough, the Drug Enforcement Agency actually approved what he was trying to do and actually acquired the cannabis in Canada, brought it across the border so he could have a supply to do his research. And without the Drug Enforcement Agency, and as I've studied a lot of places around the country, a lot of college and university areas, research areas, the Drug Enforcement Agency has been very much involved in providing funding to do real research or medical research on cannabis. So that's one of the things that's changed. Do you think if we get deregulation and decriminalization at the national level that the big pharma will be interested in studying the impact of cannabis and what it can do to help the quality of life of people?
Yeah, I think there has been long-term interest by pharma in terms of using various molecules that target these receptors, which are termed cannabinoid receptors. And it's primarily been by developing synthetic cannabinoids, so they may have some similarity in chemical structure to those that are identified in the plant, but they have very very strong propensity to bind these receptors, and so they're biologically more potent. And these compounds and many new ones have been synthesized over the years. I mean, this goes back probably 40 years now. So mm-hmm. Pharma is an interest in developing, you know, therapeutics that could target these receptors. But as you can imagine, there are serious side effects, especially if you target those receptors that are present in the brain, because they can produce, you know, the psychotropic effects, which, you know, FDA would not be very excited about.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see your research going, Doctor?
Well, I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but there are two different types of cannabinoid receptors, one of which is not expressed in any appreciable amount in the brain, but is highly expressed within the immune system. If you can target that receptor without targeting the cannabinoid receptors that are found in the brain, you have a potentially very useful immune modulating compound. And that's really where a lot of our effort has been focused on. So trying to identify cannabinoids, either plant-derived or synthetic, that can modulate the immune system without producing the psychotropic effects.
How's your progress?
I think pretty good. There are quite a few synthetic cannabinoids that have been synthesized by medicinal chemists, both in pharma and academia. And there are also naturally occurring cannabinoids in the plant that have no psychotropic activity but can modulate the immune system. So this is, this I think can be achieved.
Doctor, there are people who feel that the judgment of politicians when they created prohibition, before prohibition of alcohol, cannabis was unregulated, as was alcohol. When they brought in prohibition, they wrapped in cannabis in the prohibition along with alcohol. But when they got rid of the amendment to the Constitution, they didn't allow cannabis to be legal. And there are some doctors and researchers who believe that the human race has paid a very huge price in the opportunities that were not able to be explored in over the last 70 years with cannabis, and how it could have improved the quality of healthcare and the quality of our lives in the world. What do you think about that observation?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. And, you know, the reality is that there are always politics that are, surround these kinds of issues. And the reality also that, you know, cannabis has been used throughout human history. I mean, you can go back to probably before Christ, even, where cannabis was used, and we have written record of this. And due to its psychotropic properties, more recently, people, as you mentioned, through prohibition and legislation, have banned that. But I think as a scientist, I focused on the biology. I'm not particularly interested in the politics around this, and that's what our research is focused on. I mean, there's nothing I can do about the politics of it, other than to do good research and hope that people that make the laws will adjust them if there's a reason to do that.
Well, unfortunately, Doctor, our time is up. I knew this was going to be a great segment. We've been talking to Dr. Norman Kaminsky about inflammation and how cannabis can help deal with it. Doctor, thank you for joining us today. And how can people follow you and your research?
Again, they can look on our website at Michigan State University, the Institute for Integrative Toxicology, as well as the Center for Research on Ingredient Safety. We're actually doing a lot of work on CBD through that center, and then follow us in the peer-reviewed literature. That's where we publish our science.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety, or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.